Hey, everybody. Welcome to Across Generations, where the voices of Black women unite. I'm your host, Tiffany Cross. Join me and be a part of sisterhood, friendship, wisdom, and laughter. We gather a seasoned elder, myself as the middle generation, and a vibrant young soul for engaging intergenerational conversations. Prepare to engage or hear perspectives that literally no one else has had. Listen to Across Generations podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Jon Stewart is back in the host chair at The Daily Show, which means he's also back in our ears on The Daily Show Ears Edition podcast. Join late night legend Jon Stewart and the best news team for today's biggest headlines, exclusive extended interviews, and more. Now this is a second term we can all get behind. Listen to The Daily Show Ears Edition on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Therapy for Black Girls podcast is your space to explore mental health, personal development, and all of the small decisions we can make to become the best possible versions of ourselves. I'm your host, Dr. Joy Harden Bradford, a licensed psychologist in Atlanta, Georgia, and I can't wait for you to join the conversation every Wednesday. Listen to the Therapy for Black Girls podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Take good care, and we'll see you there.
Welcome to Creature Feature, production of iHeartRadio. I'm your host of Many Parasites, Katie Golden. I studied psychology and evolutionary biology, and today on the show, we're doing a listener questions episode. I like to answer your questions every so often. You can write to me at creaturefeaturepod@gmail.com with your questions, and I might just answer them. So let's get right into it. Wait, no, what? Before I do that, last week, I forgot to announce the winners of the Mystery Animal Sound Game. So the Mystery Animal was the koala, and the ones who guessed correctly the fastest were Magnus O, Jacob M, and Amrut K. And I apologize for forgetting to announce that. You know, I'm human. Or a koala. Koalas make mistakes, too. So let's get into the questions. First question, how accurate is the new Tarzan movie? What animals would make a real-life Tarzan? And this is from My Name is Mud, who wrote a review with the question in it. Thank you for the question and for rating the podcast. You don't have to leave your question in the reviews for me to answer them. I will still answer them if you email them to me, but I sure do appreciate it when you leave them as a review and when you leave a rating, because that helps me and the podcast, and it's great. So thank you. Well, I had no idea that there was a new Tarzan movie. I was only aware of the 1999 Tarzan. That was the Disney version where he's like, you know, skateboarding down the trees and stuff. It's not super accurate, that movie. It's a good movie, though. But, you know, animal musical sequence, talking gorillas, not super accurate. But apparently there was a live-action Tarzan in 2016. I'm assuming this is the new Tarzan you're talking about. I'm not really sure. I'm not aware of other Tarzans. But yeah, the live-action Tarzan in 2016. Apparently Alexander Skarsgård was Tarzan. I guess Alexander Skarsgård is the most gorilla-like of the Skarsgårds. There's so many Skarsgårds. Anyways, so yeah, apparently in this movie, Tarzan, like, went to England, became English, and then went back to the Congo Basin, where he had been raised by a fictional species of gorilla-like great ape called the Mangani. I don't know. So apparently he wants to investigate some kind of like slavery operation thing. I have not seen this movie. It seems pretty wild. I read the plot on Wikipedia. Apparently it has Margot Robbie and Samuel L. Jackson in it too, which, wow, all right, star-studded. The plot seems to be kind of focused on action stuff and like a conspiracy plot. There's a little bit of uncomfortable like white man's burden stuff going on there too. Anyways, yeah, I cannot review this movie because I have not seen it, but I can talk a little bit about the concepts behind Tarzan, right? Like whether it's realistic for a man to have been raised by apes, and then the these apes sort of part of the ideas that they like are able to communicate with Tarzan, who can like translate what they are saying to Jane. I don't know if this happens so much in the 2016 version, but in the Disney movie and in the original books, the apes are depicted as having a language that Tarzan understands and can translate to Jane. But this is so great ape communication is very interesting and it's complicated, and it is definitely not as simple as like being able to, like, they just have a secret language, and if we could just translate it into English, we could communicate, right? So this is why attempts to create sign language for apes has been difficult. It's been very controversial whether apes can really use sign language and to what extent. Obviously, they can learn the emotions, the hand motions, and they can learn certain like words, but it doesn't seem like we can just kind of get over our communication gap simply by sort of creating a common sign language or lexicon or something. So ape communication, I mean, obviously it depends on the species. There's the great apes. There's a lot of primates as well who use complex communication. It is a combination of vocalizations and body language, you know, like facial expressions, posture. It can be very complex. It can convey specific attitudes. It can convey danger or information, but it's not quite the same as human language. Human language is very grammatical in structure. It serves to nest concepts within one another. So you'll have a word that is symbolic for a concept or a group of concepts, and then you can arrange words in a sentence, and then you're stringing concepts together, and you can have sort of a recursion of concepts. So it can get very complicated, and that allows us to create complicated ideas. It allows us to do things like, and that whole ability of our brain to like put a concept inside another one and kind of nest things and string things together is also likely what is behind our ability to create tools and other complex creations or actions, or, you know, essentially all the things that we did to build our civilizations. Vocalizations are perhaps different, because even though you could have like a vocalization, say in a primate that has a vocalization that is a warning call, it can be pretty complex, where it's like there's a specific warning call for hawks versus snakes versus some other predator, right? Like warning or vocalizations that indicate happiness, contentment versus being upset or angry, or like a call that means come here or a call that means run away. You know, there are a lot of like complex vocalizations, postures, methods of communication that primates and great apes are capable of. But right, there's this distinction between that and can they actually form like a sentence with grammar? It is an interesting question, and there's definitely been attempts to get apes to learn essentially a form of language that we can communicate with, like sign language or lexicon. There is a lot of like debate though about how effective this is. So there are apes, like the famous one, the most famous one actually is probably Coco the gorilla, who was taught sign language, which is kind of, it's really tricky because it's like not really clear. Like, she definitely learned how to make signs with her hands, and she definitely learned that certain signs would get her something, like a treat, or might indicate, stand in for a word or something. But sign language is not just, sign language is, you know, it is a whole language. It's not just like, here's a hand gesture that means this thing. Sign language has a syntax, it has grammatical structure. It is just like verbal language. You're able to nest concepts into sign language. And so Coco's version of this signing may not have actually qualified as a language. A more perhaps compelling example of an ape being able to learn something akin to a language would be Kanzi the bonobo, who seemed to be able to learn to string together very simple phrases using lexigram. So a lexigram being like a symbol that stands in for a whole word, like a like you have sort of a symbol that's like a few lines or a circle, and then that whole that symbol just means orange. You don't have letters, you just have the symbol that represents the word. And so Kanzi, the bonobo, was able to memorize a ton of these lexigrams and actually seemed to be able to combine them in a way that indicated a very, very simple grammatical structure. So say like he picked a lexigram, a symbol that meant play, and then another symbol that meant hide. And so that's saying sort of like he wants to play hide and go seek. And then he would actually do that behavior. So yeah, impressively, he seemed to be able to come up with some very simple structures of these lexigrams that indicated a creative combination of concepts, which is actually something also seen in deaf children who were raised in groups. Like you would have maybe like a school for deaf children, and they'd be in a group and they would spontaneously come up with sign language that they used with each other, because human beings are so primed for language. We're so social and we're so primed with language. In the absence of someone teaching us a language, children are able to kind of spontaneously come up with a language when they are together, when they're with other children, when they're able to socialize. But Kanzi, even though he was raised since infancy by humans, still runs into issues drafting more complex sentences than, like, say, a two-word construction or something that maybe has multiple concepts kind of like nested in one another. So his ability to use these lexigrams is really impressive, but it seems like he's still not able to get past grammatical structure of like a young toddler in a human. So like there seems to still be kind of an upper limit in terms of how apes can kind of truly understand or truly use grammar to sort of string concepts together. And so back to this idea of Tarzan, like, is it possible for a human child to be raised by apes and, you know, kind of live as a happy family? I don't know. I think strictly speaking, it may be possible. But the thing is, we've never actually had any concrete evidence of this truly happening. So there's this idea of like the feral child, the wild, you know, the kid raised by wolves like Mowgli and the Jungle Book. But all of this is fiction. There have been quote unquote feral children. That's kind of not like a great word for it, though, because most of the times, like, these so-called feral children are just children who have been severely, severely neglected. It's not like a kid who went off and was adopted by wolves as a baby. It's usually a child who was so neglected that they were kept somewhere away from other people, so they weren't unable to socialize with anyone. And it's, you know, fortunately, this is seems to be extremely rare. But yeah, there were like a few cases of children being kept in such severe neglect that they never learned how to speak because they never had anyone talk to them, which is really, really sad. It's really awful. There was this case of this girl born in the 50s, like, I think the social workers named her Jeannie, but she was severely neglected and abused. She was like locked in a room with no interaction. And like there, after she was quote unquote, you know, rescued by social workers, there were a lot of researchers interested in her language acquisition who tried to teach her how to speak. And it only kind of partially worked. Like she was able to pick up some words, communicate a little bit better. But unfortunately, when she went into like a care home, apparently she was again neglected and subject to isolation. It's a really, really sad case. It's and I don't know that it really is clarifying in terms of language acquisition. You know, it's like, I mean, first of all, it's a little bit, I don't know, grim, this idea of like using this child who was severely abused and neglected in terms of like research about language acquisition. It's kind of yucky all around. But yeah, like, I mean, in this case, right, like she was just subject to severe neglect, and it's kind of hard to know how it would work, say, like if a child was abandoned in a forest and got picked up by apes or something. It's just not something that has ever been documented to have happened. And so, you know, I think, though, to maybe end the section on a more positive note, I think it is really amazing that both humans and animals seem to be capable of some empathy towards like other species, right? Like, you know, Coco the gorilla really did have like a kitten that she really loved. There's a lot of cases of like animals seeming to show tenderness, not only towards their own species, but towards other species. And certainly humans, you know, are capable of great amounts of empathy towards, you know, their own species as well as other species. So I think that it could be possible, right? Like if you had like a human baby, I would think that some, maybe bonobos would be the best candidates just in terms of like being very gentle. Gorillas are possibly, yeah, I don't know, because they're not that aggressive, but just the sheer strength, there might be, you know, some unwitting accidents with a human child. But yeah, I mean, it's an interesting idea, but so far it has only truly happened in fiction. Next question. Hi, Katie. I've been trying to find the paper you referenced in the Odd Couples episode about researchers skinning frogs with mutualistic relationships with tarantulas. I mentioned it to my herpetology professor, and now I can't seem to find it. Can you help me? Thanks, Hannah. Hi, Hannah. Thanks for the question. So yeah, this was an episode, I think, from 2020. So that was a while ago. But yeah, so to recap, in the episode that Han mentions, we talked about the relationship between the dotted humming frog, which is a tiny brown frog in South America, who would be perfectly comfortable sitting on the tip of your thumb. It's only about half an inch long. And they seem to be friends with tarantulas of the genus Pamphobatius. These tarantulas, despite being perfectly happy eating other kinds of frogs, and they enjoy the company of these little cute humming frogs or other microhylid frogs species, and don't seem to eat them. So the theory is that the frog gets protection from his big spider friend, and maybe the spider gets some benefit from the frog. The frog eats a lot of ants, so maybe it eats ants that would pose a threat to the tarantula's eggs. So this is the theory in terms of this mutualistic relationship. And as I mentioned in that episode, there was a zany researcher who skinned some of these little microhylid humming frogs and put their hides on another species of frog that is actually known to be like something that the tarantula is willing to eat. And this researcher seemed to find that when she put the skin of the friend frog on the food frog, the tarantula got confused and did not eat the food frog. So it's not a big surprise that you couldn't find the paper, because this was actually from an unpublished master's report from 2002 by Jolene Sacani. So her 2002 work was referenced in other papers in a Scientific American article, but I couldn't find like any further research from her or any follow-up research reproducing her results. I don't necessarily want to like tell people to do another study where they like do a Buffalo Bill skinning of these adorable little frogs and put them on other frogs. But technically, probably if you really wanted make sure that this is reproducible, one would need to do that. But there might actually be a way to do it without skinning the frogs, like maybe sort of isolating compounds in the frog's skin to see what it is that is signaling to the tarantula that it should not eat this frog. So there was actually a study in 2012 by Dundee, Shillington, and Yeary called Interactions Between Tarantulas, Aphonopelma hintzi, and Narrow-Mouthed Toads, Gastrophrine olivaceae, Port for a Symbiotic Relationship. So these researchers housed tarantulas with the microhyoid frogs, as well as a similar-sized small species of frogs, a crooked frog, so it's a frog, not a cricket, but confusingly, they also put crickets in and also roaches just to make sure that these tarantulas would eat things that they are known to eat. So they found that the tarantulas loved eating the crickets and the cockroaches, and they would, pretty frequently eat the cricket frog. So this is a frog that is not known to have a friendship with these tarantulas. And so the tarantulas would eat this similarly sized small frog that it was naive to. And but then they found that the tarantula never ate the microhyoid frog, the G. olivaceae frog. And so they also never seemed to try to attack the frog. So the authors speculate that there is either an obvious olfactory cue that allows them to immediately recognize the little microhyoid friend frog as unpalatable, or they've learned not to eat the frog through experience. So also the idea is that maybe their skin contains a compound that is slightly toxic or irritating or unpalatable, but there also seems to be another dynamic for why the tarantula not only doesn't eat or attack the frog, but just tolerates the frog's presence, because it does not get defensive around the frog when the frog is near its egg sac. It allows the frog to approach its egg sac. So this is kind of lends itself to the idea that the frog will eat the ants that could pose a threat to the egg sac, and the tarantula is basically going to let the frog do what it wants, and is comfortable being around the frog because they have this mutualistic relationship that it's either learned or has some kind of instinctive response to allow. A cute detail of the study is that sometimes the tarantulas would rest their pedipalps on their little friend frog. So the pedipalps are those little, they look like little hands or arms at the sort of near the tarantula's mouth and face. So it doesn't necessarily mean that they're being affectionate towards the frog. That's not necessarily like spider lingo for affection, but it's cute, right? I think we can enjoy a little cuteness from this tarantula-frog friendship. All right, on to the next listener question. Hello, and many thanks for the podcast. I was wondering if feeding wild birds and providing nest boxes in our own yards was a net positive for native birds, or just another example of human intervention throwing off the balance. Speaking of helping wild bird populations, I've attached a photo of Waffles, the adopted street kitten, who now lives a strictly indoor life with me. Best wishes for a great 2024 from Adam. Thank you. And congratulations on being adopted by the adorable and magnanimous Waffles. You are guaranteed to be saving a lot of bird lives by adopting a street cat and keeping cute little murder Waffles indoors. And Waffles will also be safer from cars and coyotes and so on. So great job there. Feeding birds. So is it good or not good for birds? Obviously, if you ask a bird, it'll tell you to shut up and just give it some more bread, because they love bread and they will eat food that is yummy, even if it's technically not good for them, like bread. So bread and other kind of human foods, not so great for birds. That said, feeding birds, I wouldn't say that it is just always bad, right? It depends on what you're feeding them, when you feed them, how much, what kind of feeder. There's all these kind of conditions. So like if you feed ducks bread, that's not really great. If you really want to feed ducks, you can feed them frozen peas that have been kind of thawed out. Seeds and grains can also be okay. Or sorry, not for the ducks. Seeds and grains are good for other birds. Ducks will actually eat oats and corn as well as peas. And it's a good alternative for bread. To bread for ducks, but it's still possible to like overfeed them or leave too much of the food in their habitat, which can like encourage algae growth or You know, like rats attract rats, which can attack their eggs. So, you know, I would just say in a kind of moderation, like a modest amount of peas rather than dumping in huge bowls is probably fine. Like if you just, you see a duck, you give it a few peas, that's probably fine. As long as you don't overdo it. As far as backyard birds go, like songbirds and finches and other birds you get in your backyard, seeds and grains can sometimes help them through the winter, but it can also backfire. So too much nutritional richness at the wrong time of year might cause a bird to go into its breeding season early. And what might happen in that case is that if its chicks hatch too early, they might actually miss the timing for like the insect season. And so it actually might reduce the ability of these chicks to survive. Another issue with feeding backyard birds is if you have like a really large like feeder where a bunch of birds congregate at, like say bird flu is going around and they're all congregating, that might help spread a bird flu or another disease. But, you know, don't like throw out all your bird seed or bird feeders yet. Like we'll get into like what exactly you can do to kind of feed birds. So, I mean, one thing is if you want to be safe without doing too much research, things like water stones, bird baths, or planting native plants that bear either fruit or seeds or nectar that is attractive to birds is totally great. But if you have time to kind of do some research into your local native birds, their sort of seasonality, their migration patterns, and their natural diet, you can probably like put out some bespoke food for them, like instead of in one giant like feeder, kind of scattering it around your yard, and which is kind of nice because then you would attract birds to different locations. And you can also look up like for your region when food is really scarce, when birds really struggle versus when they kind of are fine and you don't really need to put out any food. You know, so basically what I would say is if you enjoy feeding birds, I don't think you should necessarily just stop. I think you should like commit to it even more. Research your local bird needs. Figure out like which food is best for them. Create like little fun feeding nooks, or maybe even just like plant some native fruit bearing trees or shrubs that the birds will like. Like you could take it to a whole new level of nerding out over birds rather than just like giving up on your bird feeding hobby. I would say that, yeah, like if you want to feed the birds safely, there's not like advice just I can give to everyone in general, because it's going to depend where you live, what kind of birds you have there. But yeah, like look into what populations of birds you have, what is sort of suggested for your region. You could even like, you know, if you have sort of local bird refuge, you could write to them and find out like what season is the best to leave out food for birds and what kind of food is the best. I think that it's really commendable to enjoy interacting with nature. I think there's no shame in wanting to do that. But yeah, if we like when you go like for a little extra effort in terms of doing research about how exactly to do it, you're going to do it in a much more safe way that's going to be more beneficial to the birds and less likely to create these kind of like difficult to predict like effects such as altering their breeding season. In terms of nesting boxes are great, especially when you live in a region where, say, there's a lot of building and not as much like forest or natural habitat. Just make sure they're sort of the right size for your local birds. Like the aperture of the hole in the nesting box can be important. Also, if you have snakes in your area, you might want a certain size of birdhouse, like the opening small enough for the bird to get in, but too small for like certain types of predators or snakes. You can also put nesting boxes on a pole or use like anti-predator cones to protect the boxes. I would avoid using things like netting because that can be both harmful to like snakes and to birds because they can get tangled in it. And we don't want to hurt the snakes, right? Like, we like snakes. We just don't want to necessarily serve them baby birds on a platter, make their job any easier to get to the baby birds. So I think it's wonderful to want to, you know, help your local bird population. So I would highly encourage it, and I would encourage you to do it by really getting familiar with your local species and finding out what suits them the best, the kinds of things that really suit them. And I think that's would make for a very fun project. All right, so thank you guys so much for writing to me your questions. Always enjoy doing this. Always sends me on interesting paths for research, so love that. If you have a question that you'd like me to answer, you can write to me at creaturefeaturepod@gmail.com. You can also leave a review of my podcast where you rate it, you review it, and if you leave me a question there, I will read those as well. Again, you don't have to leave a rating or review for me to answer your question. I answer the ones sent to me by email just as much, but if you would like to, that is really nice. And thanks to the Space Cossacks for their super awesome song, Exolumina. We will do the animal sound guessing game next time. Thank you guys so much. Creature Feature is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts like the one you just heard, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or hey, guess what? Wherever you listen to your favorite show. I don't judge you. I'm not your mother. You gotta live your life. Make mistakes, get messy. Am I doing Miss Frizzle? I don't mean to do Miss Frizzle. Anyways, I'll see you guys next Wednesday.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to Across Generations, where the voices of Black women unite. I'm your host, Tiffany Cross.
Tiffany Cross.
Join me and be a part of sisterhood, friendship, wisdom, and laughter. We gather a seasoned elder, myself as the middle generation, and a vibrant young soul for engaging intergenerational conversations. Prepare to engage or hear perspectives that literally no one else has had. Listen to Across Generations podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Jon Stewart is back in the host chair at The Daily Show, which means he's also back in our ears on The Daily Show Ears Edition podcast. Join late night legend Jon Stewart and the best news team for today's biggest headlines, exclusive extended interviews, and more. Now this is a second term we can all get behind. Listen to The Daily Show Ears Edition on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Therapy for Black Girls podcast is your space to explore mental health, personal development, and all of the small decisions we can make to become the best possible versions of ourselves. I'm your host, Dr. Joy Harden Bradford, a licensed psychologist in Atlanta, Georgia, and I can't wait for you to join the conversation every Wednesday. Listen to the Therapy for Black Girls podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Take good care, and we'll see you there.